okay, what's going on?
AudioToYou.com.
The home of quality podcasts.
Stay tuned to this channel.
Shutters Inc. with Bruce Williams and Shelton Muller.
Hi, and welcome to episode 114 of Shutters Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuttersIncPodcast.com, and with me on the line once again, back from 40 years in the wilderness, the Moses of the photography world, Mr. Shelton Muller. How are you?
Look, it's good to be back. I'm telling you, I've missed you all so much. These 10 commandments.
It is good to be back. But look, like Moses in the wilderness, I've sent my 10 spies into the land.
Right.
And I must admit, I'm shocked. I'm absolutely shocked to hear that some Shutters Inc. listeners have been sleeping with other podcasts. Now, what's your take on this, Bruce?
Well, yes, I've seen a few things around myself which have alerted me to that fact, and in their defense, I can't blame them. It's certainly been tough on you and I to organize, you know, recording time. I'd like to think that they are still loyal Shutters Inc. listeners as well.
Yeah.
And that they're, you know, very glad to hear this new episode out at last. as are you and I.
Yeah. And we do apologize, gang, but between Bruce's schedule and mine, you know, this has been very, very difficult to coordinate. Bruce came to Melbourne and I was so busy I couldn't even see him.
Yes.
I had so many little personal emergencies. You weren't
rejected.
Snubbed, my friend. You weren't snubbed. Our good friend Richard Annable was able to make up where I
he
left off.
He did. He made the effort.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's just my subliminal way of paying you back, my subconscious way of paying you back for not taking up, you know, your time on 5 minute photographer. I don't know. It just could be a subconscious thing.
Maybe.
But look, I was just so busy and had a few personal emergencies going on, but I just couldn't do it. So you're going to have to come to Melbourne again, and I'm just going to have to, you know, we're going to have to hire a swimsuit model or something and, you know, go for a shoot somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
If my woman and your woman don't mind, of course.
Yeah.
Yes, there is that.
We had a great time while we were down there, though.
Yeah, we had a really good time.
Took Max
I'm
over
glad.
To the Science Works Museum at Spotswood, which was absolutely fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Did a tour of the old Melbourne jail and got arrested for half an hour.
Cool, isn't that interesting?
That's an interesting tour, I can tell you.
I mean, you're thrown into prison?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for those who don't know, the old Melbourne jail and the watch house, the old Melbourne jail is no longer functional, but I think the watch house still is, isn't it, Shelton?
I'm not sure. I couldn't tell you.
It's been a couple of weeks since he was locked up, so...
Yeah, that's right.
But basically what they do with this tour...
But the court case is pending.
Yeah, exactly. What they do with this tour is you go to the watch house at the beginning of the tour, like at, you know, 11 o'clock or whatever, and this woman comes out, you know, a police officer, and she hands you a card that is your rap sheet. So it tells you what your name is and what you were caught doing and where you were caught doing it and what your address is and the arresting officer and all this stuff. And for the next half an hour, she treats you like a criminal. And you are arrested.
And you pay for this?
Yeah. And seriously, like, she is right in your face. You know, she's like, you stand against that wall and do not speak until spoken to. And like, she's like full on for half an hour. And
does she say, how can you have your pudding if you don't eat your meat? Does she say that?
No.
You can't have any pudding if you don't eat your meat. No? Oh, fair enough.
It's funny that you should mention that, because this week was the unfortunate passing of Richard Wright.
Yes, it was. Yes, very true. Sorry, I interrupted your flow. We can get back to Mr. Blake later.
But she, you know, she takes you through into the watch house and she actually puts you, like, she separates the guys from the girls and she puts you each into a cell and you are told that you have to stand and face the wall, and she turns the lights out and locks the cell. So you're in complete darkness. And it's pretty full on. Like, Max was staying pretty close to me, I can tell you. And Yeah, and at the end of the sort of the end of the half hour, she says, "Look, you know, my name's Wendy so and so. I'm an actress," and she said, "Yeah, really, I'm a nice person." but she says, "You know, what you've experienced in the last half hour is exactly what it's like if you do get picked up drunk and disorderly on a Friday night. This is what you will go through."
Wow.
Yeah. she sort of looks at the kids and says, "You know, kids, you don't want to end up here."
No. It's an interesting place. I remember I took Nathan, my son, there. That is probably a new feature because that wasn't there when we went there.
Right.
But it's a new feature. Yeah. Mm. But I'm glad you enjoyed our fair town. Did you get a chance to try out the Lygon Street restaurants?
We did twice. We went to Il Gambero, the Little Prawn, which is a family-run pizzeria that has been, I think, in the same family for 40 years.
Yeah.
And Lying they like just that. Do awesome pizzas. I could not speak highly enough of Il Gambero. And then on the Monday night when we hooked up with the gang from Linda, we went to the Land of Siam, which was a Thai restaurant, not that far from Il Gambero, on the same side of Lygon Street. I had some absolutely gorgeous Thai food there. But what I do want to talk about is down at St. Kilda, just across the road from Luna Park, you've got a Macca's. And if you keep following in a straight line to the other side of...
Hungry Joe's?
I think it's Ackland Street. Yeah, no, not Hungry, not Greasy Joe's. A couple of doors up from Greasy Joe's is a Spanish place called Spuntino, I think it was called.
Yep.
They had the best coffee I have ever had.
Oh, really?
It was awesome. And I actually said so to the barista. I said, you know, I said, everyone talks about the coffee culture between Sydney and Melbourne. I said, that is hands down the best coffee I've ever had. I said, I don't know why, but in Sydney, every coffee I have, it always tastes a little bit bitter. It's always too strong and yada, yada, yada. And we had quite a good chat about the making of coffee. And yeah, it was phenomenal. And we went there for breakfast and I had this Spanish, it's kind of an omelette, I guess. And it was just absolutely divine. So if you're in the St. Kilda region, anyone, and I know you don't live far from there, mate, you're a bit further down the road, but
yeah, but my good friend Greg Bayer, fellow photographer and very good friend, lives in Ackland Street. Literally he'd be 40 seconds walk from, you know.
You're kidding.
Yeah, from that restaurant. So next time I'm down there, he offers me a coffee, I'll say, mate, let's just head down the street. Okay, well, I'm glad you had a good time in Melbourne.
We did.
And did you get your camera out while you were here? Did you head down there? Did you manage to get down to the Brighton bathing boxes?
No. No. I mean, I got the camera out a couple of times, but I didn't get to do as much creative stuff as I would have liked. It was more just, you know, ripping off a few shots here and there as we were wandering around, because we were only there for 4 days, you know, and we had, 3 days, really. And so, you know, I was trying to do family stuff and... You know, had I been able to hook up with you or, you know, Richard for a photo walk, then probably would have got to have done some more creative stuff. But it was really just a case of, you know, let's grab some shots while we're here and move on sort of thing. So.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, you know, next time, mate.
Yeah,
next time.
Absolutely. So, photographically, what have we got?
Mate, it's been, of course, so long, I can't even remember what we talked about last time. What's been released, I don't know.
I think they just released the box brownie.
Yes, okay, fair enough. Well, we've come a bit since. Color photography has been introduced since then.
Oh, serious?
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, absolutely. Color photography. Do you remember me talking about my part in the D700 launch?
No.
Okay, well, I was involved in the Camera Action Camera House D700 launch here in Melbourne.
Right.
That was excellent. That was when I have had a chance to shoot with said camera. And in fact, Nikon are going to... Oh, it was just fantastic. For my troubles, Nikon are giving me a D700.
Oh, nice.
I just can't wait to get my damn hands on the thing. They're taking their time, but I know there's been, you know, such a demand for the thing.
Yeah.
Stock has been the issue, but this is just an awesome piece of gear. It's their enthusiast, you know, version of the D3, you might say, with the same sensor, 12 megapixel, 35 millimeter size sensor.
Now, hang on, you've been shooting with the D300 up until now, correct?
D200. I would have gone the D300, but now, of course, with the D700, I'm just bypassing the D300 and going the next step up.
Right.
And look, to be honest with you, it's about time Nikon did introduce, and they have introduced, with the D3 a little over a year ago, what Canon have called, or others called, the full frame sensor. Now, you know, I hate that expression.
Yep.
But the 35mm sensor, which Nikon cleverly calls the FX size instead of DX size.
Right.
And I think that's been a very, very clever move. That's a CMOS sensor.
Mm-hmm.
12 megapixel, which I think is interesting because they haven't crammed this sensor full of pixels. When you consider that it's a fair bit larger than an APS-C size sensor, they didn't say, oh, well, let's just cram it full of pixels. They only kept it to 12.
Yeah.
Now, there are APS-C size sensors that have more pixels than that.
Yeah.
You know, the new 50D Canon has 15 megapixels. So, and it's a smaller sensor.
So I would imagine the noise coming out of the 700 would be very minimal.
It's nothing.
Really?
In fact, if you go to my blog, on that particular evening, I was ready to go for when everybody turned up. Then I grabbed the camera and I walked the streets. Now, by this time, the sun had set in Melbourne. When the sun sets in Melbourne, you know, that's it.
Yeah, so after 4 o'clock,
it's dark. And I walked across the street and Sorry?
I said, you missed that. I said yes, after probably. 4 o'clock.
Oh, yeah. Well, at that time of year, pretty much.
Yeah.
I walked across the street into a sort of a little cake and coffee place, and I had the camera set at 3200 ISO.
Right.
And I just walked in and I said, oh, can I take a couple of pictures? And the guys behind the counter posed, etc. And I took a shot of them. Now, the camera was on auto exposure and auto white balance, and it was at 3200 ISO. Now, anybody who wants to see the full size picture that I took of these two fellas posing and fooling around behind the counter, go to my blog.
Mm-hmm.
Which you can access via my website, and have a look at the picture. You can actually have a look at the full image at 3200 ISO. Just click on the picture and it'll open up the real one, and you'll see that at 3200 ISO, you've got to keep zooming in and zooming in and zooming in until you see noise at 3200 ISO.
Wow.
I took some photographs during a workshop recently, and again, I was working with the D3 this time, which is exactly the same sensor and exactly the same technology. And I photographed all day at 3200 because I needed to prepare images for the D700 launch. And I photographed all day, even outside in bright sunlight, etc., at 3200 ISO. And you're taking head and shoulder portraits of models and whatever. And you have to zoom right in on this girl's eyelid before you see noise.
Wow.
And again, there's a sample of that on my blog. We took these photographs and we enlarged them to 24 by 30 inch, and we showed people at the D700 launch, and they couldn't believe it. They could not believe that you can shoot that high and still not see noise. So for the available light wedding portrait child photographer, it's the perfect camera.
Mm.
It really is. Because with children inside, they're running around, etc. Out with wedding work, you're working with available light. You don't want to, add awful flash unless it's maybe some really cool off-camera flash techniques. But you really want to use, want to find the light and put them in it, which is our mantra here.
Yep.
And with this camera, you can, because you can shoot at 3200, 1600 ISO, and just not even worry about it.
Wow.
It's like shooting at 400 ISO on the standard, DSLR. Guys who own the D3 and the D700 are saying there's no point shooting below 800 ISO because there's just no difference.
Whoa.
Yeah. Whereas on my D200 at 800 ISO, you're really starting to see the noise, and you're really loathe. You swallow hard and you put it at 800 and you go, oh, well, I'll just have to bear it and grin it or, blow it out with Gaussian blur in Photoshop or something. But in this particular camera, you don't, there's no point. The only reason that you would go to a lower ISO is if you, for some reason, needed a slower shutter speed or less depth of field or something like that. There's really very little reason to do so.
Mm.
So that's how impressive that camera is, and I can't wait to get my hands on one. I'm going to Patagonia in November to lead a photo tour there, and I'll be taking that one with me. And I'm really looking forward to the larger size sensor because it does give you greater dynamic range. and I'll be looking forward to, you know, shooting with a nice 20mm Nikkor or a prime, you know, wide angle.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be looking forward to being able to shoot, you know, at dawn and dusk, etc., and still, you know, get excellent resolution, even if I have to bump up the ISO just a little bit.
I was just about to say, the advantage of that is that you're going to have to reach for your tripod less often.
Yes, especially with a wedding, that is a real serious advantage.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you can point and grab, you know, shots all the time.
Just keeps you moving, yeah.
Absolutely, keeps you moving, and that is a really great advantage. I recently had the D3 on a wedding, and I shot all day, no less than 800 ISO. I mean, there was no point, as I say.
Yeah.
And Troy, who's one of the guys at 5-Minute Photographer, came with me, and he could not believe what I was pulling out of this camera at 3,200. And
wow.
By the end of the, just before we left, I was doing a portrait in candlelight at 6,400 ISO. So, you know, it was just unbelievable. So, and the great thing about it was, yes, I've been a big advocate of using tripod, but because it stops, it makes you think, etc., and I still believe in that. But the great thing about this camera and its ability to handle noise at high ISOs is that it does, with the wedding particularly, keep you moving, gives you greater opportunity for spontaneity, more variations on a theme because you're not having to move a tripod and blah, blah, blah. You can just, you know, shoot away, and it's fantastic. But there have been a couple of answers to Nikon since then, of course.
Yep.
The Sony having released one, the A900.
Yep.
And, of course, just recently, the long-awaited, you know, Mark II of the Canon 5D.
Yeah.
Now, interesting, you know, Sony's basically take on this was, well, let's do a full frame, in other words, or a larger sensor.
Yeah.
But let's throw more pixels at it.
Yeah.
Look, the Sony seems to be a great camera, 24.6 megapixel resolution, and they have fabulous lenses. It's a 100% viewfinder.
But you know, I'm with you though. I would have preferred to have seen less photo sites on the sensor, but still increase the size of the sensor so that you reduce the noise.
Yes.
I mean,
exactly.
We've beaten this horse to death about, you know, the number of pixels is not the issue.
Yeah.
No one needs that many.
No. It's true. Although, look, I was talking with photographer Darren Leal the other day, and Darren likes to produce very large prints, and that's part of his thing. He does a gallery that shoots with a 35mm type camera. And I said to him, well, what about the D3, Darren? He's looking at getting a new camera system. And what about the Nikon D3 for you? You know, and he said, look, it's only 12 megapixels. And I said, are you kidding? You know, and he says, well, for what I do, you know, I need more pixels. So, you know, maybe there is a story here. Conversely, though, I was having lunch with Margaret Brown. And Margaret Brown is one of Australia's...
When you say he's doing large prints, I mean, how large are we talking?
We're
not talking roadside billboard size.
No, we're not. We're talking, I don't know, maybe, you know,
A0?
I don't know what that size is, but, you know, three, four feet, you know, in size, maybe a little larger, banner sizes sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, look, to be honest with you, I think if you've got enough pixels, and gee, 12 is enough pixels, then upsizing software is going to take care of the rest, because it's just about having enough pixels to manage the pixels across and down, not necessarily the resolution. Darren disagrees with me on this.
Okay.
But, you know, and I have to bow to his wisdom, but I wouldn't necessarily worry myself. Sony's answer has been to make it a 24.6 megapixel, in other words, twice, you know, well, no, it's not really technically twice the resolution of the Nikon, but it's, you know, twice the amount of megapixels in, you know, 24.6. And I just wonder, to me, the advantage is that, you know, you have larger photo sites, better dynamic range, and because you're not cramming the pixels in, there isn't so much energy transfer between the photo sites, so you have less noise. That, to me, is the situation. However, I have not seen images from the Sony. And the Canon, of course, they've gone the same route. Canon have said, well, let's answer Nikon, or let's do what we're going to do, and they've got a 21.1 megapixel sensor in the new 5D Mark II. They've also added live view movies. In other words, you can capture high resolution video with the 5D, which the D700 and the D3 don't have, but the new Nikon D90.
Yeah, I don't get that. I just don't understand the motivation for going that route.
I do, in one way. I mean, I do. I think, for instance, let's put it this, let's talk about it from just one example. You've got your camera set up on a tripod, you're photographing a wedding, you're taking a picture, you're set up father and daughter, you know, and there she is, all dolled up and in her wedding dress, and you're doing the father-daughter snap at home. But while you've got your camera set up, they're having a little bit of a banter, and, you know, he's talking to his daughter, and they're having a bit of a laugh, or a bit of a cuddle or whatever, you know. You can surreptitiously video the whole thing before you take the picture. And there'll be moments throughout the day that you could do this with. If you set up a landscape, you know, and you're doing maybe a bit of a documentary shoot or through a country, like I will be in Patagonia, you can do, you know, 10 seconds of video of each landscape and put them into like a, you know...
On your DVD, yeah.
Yeah, you know, you could make a little video based, and it is high resolution and it's brilliant. You know, the sound issues will be, you know, the thing, because it's a little microphone at the front. So you'd probably want to do a, you know, backing track of music or narration or that kind of thing. But I see that there's certainly value in having it. If you're, the D90 is a family snap. It's designed for the enthusiast who wants to take great pictures of his holidays and his family and that kind of thing. So, hey, you're photographing your child and he's playing. Well, you can just snap into video mode and just do some video. I see it as a plus. Definitely don't see it as a disadvantage. Just needs to be thought of and used. It's going to, I could see it coming. It was the next way that, you know, DSLRs were had to go. But I just wonder, you know, as I was saying, I was having lunch with a few people. We went up for the Nikon launch recently for the D90, and we were there a little early, so we crossed the road and we went to a cafe, and a few of us, Mark Gaffin, the editor of Capture magazine, Margaret Brown, Don Norris, a few of these, we're all, you know, sitting around having a coffee. And I was saying, look, you know, we were talking about the D700, because Don Norris he's one of these great tech whizzes in this country. He's a great guy. He had a D700 around his neck, and he said he absolutely loves it. And we were talking about, you know, we were waiting for the Canon release. And Margaret Brown piped up, and she's a very outspoken woman. She's an incredibly intelligent woman and is one of the best camera reviewers I've ever known. Very technically minded and very outspoken. You don't want to bring out a rubbish product, you know, and have her review it, because if she thinks it's stupid, man, she'll let everybody know. And I admire that. You know, she's not bought or sold by anybody, and I think that's fantastic. And she was saying, look, the D700, the D3, fabulous cameras. You know, I would suggest that the D700 will get, you know, camera of the year. But she was saying, like, when Canon comes out, when they bring out the 5D Mark II, I hope they don't go the megapixel route, is what she said. Oh, let's compete by throwing more pixels at it. And I think that coming from her was, you know, a very intelligent thing to say, especially with a lady with her technical understanding and her experience. So whether this is going to be a good or bad thing, I've yet to see images with the A900, and I've yet to see naturally images from the very recently released Canon 5D Mark II, but I'd love to see a comparison between, say, the D700 and the D3 at 3200 ISO and the Sony and the Canon. I hope that the Sony and the Canon stand up, and this is me, a Nikon devotee, talking. But I hope they stand up for the sake of Sony and Canon users. I mean, you're a Sony user, or you will be. You're a Minolta user now, but I'd suggest you'll probably end up getting the the A900 or similar, because it does look like an awesome piece of gear. I hope that the images stand up and that we're all going to see across the board lower noise, higher ISO, you know, capabilities in the cameras. It would be really great.
Interesting that you mention ISO, because that was the one thing that I, you know, just jumped off the page at me with regarding the Canon 5D Mark II.
Mm-hmm.
The maximum ISO rating on that thing. I thought it was a misprint. And I've gone, no, that can't be right. And I've gone off to DP Review to check it out. And sure enough, they were quoting the same figure. It's something like, what was it, 25,000 something or 20,000?
25,600, yeah.
Now, obviously, they must be just using an algorithm to multiply the light values, surely.
Yeah, they are. I mean, the D700 and the D3 do the same thing, but they just call it high one, high two. Once you get past 6400, you know, you go to 12,500 or whatever, and then 12,000, whatever, and then 25,000, but they just call it high one, high two. They don't actually put a number on it. They're just basically saying, this is freaking me out.
So it's got to be as noisy as all get out, surely.
It starts to get very, very noisy, even with the D700 and the D3. But, you know, again, a net less noise, a lot less noise than what it would have otherwise been. The Canon have got... what Canon have done, and I find this interesting, the 5D Mark II has a range from 50 ISO to 25,600. They've actually put numbers on it. The Nikon goes the same way, but you know, they've got low, and then they get into 200, and then they go to 6400, and then they say high. They don't actually put a numerical figure on it.
Yeah.
Canon has put a numerical figure on it, and I think Sony have as well. Sony have said that it's a 6400 ISO expandable.
Right.
So that's what the way they've put it, whereas Canon have given it a number.
Yeah.
And you know, that's basically what they're doing. And I don't know whether you'd be able to get a meter out and use that number reliably, but that's basically what they're doing. So there's some serious competition between these cameras.
I must say, I was glad to see that it went down to 50 ISO though, because that's something that's pretty rare on digital SLRs.
Yeah. Yes, it is. Of course, Nikon do the same thing, but they just call it low. You know, you can go below the 200, but you start to lose image quality, actually.
Oh, okay.
Don't do it. Don't do it. You start to lose quality in the image. So, you know, don't do it. No point. And like I say, the guys who are owning D3s and D700s say there's no point shooting below, you know, 800 ISO. Very little point at all. David Oliver, one of Australia's, you know, top photographers, renowned photographers in this country, I was talking to him, and he said, oh, I shoot my weddings average 1600, 3200 ISO, you know, don't worry me. And I'm thinking, and you see the poster size images he produced from the camera, you just, well, wow, you know, it really is quite wonderful. And I hope the Sony and the Canon stand up. I know, and here we are talking about pixels, I know that there are rumors that Nikon will be bringing out, of course, a D3X or something like that, which will be a 20-odd megapixel DSLR, and that'll be for those who want that kind of resolution. I hope that when they do, you know, that it will at least hold up noise-wise, but it'll be something for photographers to say, look, do I want pixels or do I want low noise?
Yeah.
Personally, I think we've got enough pixels now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Enough pixels now. It's an interesting world we live in.
Absolutely.
But the Canon and the Sony are very well priced. I haven't received a price on the 5D Mark II yet, but you know, rumors are it'll be very competitive with the D700, and yet has, you know, the 21 megapixel resolution. The Sony, you know, I have received a recommended retail on that.
It's about $3,000 Australian.
It'll be about $3,900. It's the recommended retail.
Okay.
Yeah, the recommended retail is $44.99. Now that will make it. That will bring it down in shops at $39.99. But then, of course, competition and you know, wholesaler rebates, etc., will make that more comparable. And it will definitely go up against the D700. But at 24 megapixel resolution, 100%, you know, viewfinder, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Basically, Nikon have got a competitor on their hands there. Depending on what Canon do with the 5D Mark II, then if people are more into pixels than, you know, low noise, or say the Canon and the Sony compare in noise, well, then the D700 is going to be in trouble. But, you know, it's interesting. They're very, very interesting. I don't think they'll be able to match the noise quality, but if they can at that pixel rate, going to be quite incredible. Quite incredible indeed. And in fact, to be honest with you, having seen images that David Oliver shot with the D90 at 3200 ISO, I saw poster size images, I couldn't see any noise.
And that's aimed at more amateur photographers than pros, yeah.
Yeah, Which is great if you think about it.
Yeah.
Because they don't, you know, if you can tell an amateur, just check the thing on 1600, mate, you know.
Yeah.
and he just bangs away with his family snaps. He's not having to pop up the flash and ruin everything and get red eye. Mm. You know, he can just bang away in available light and photograph his children as they play and not, you know, and get a nice 5x7 inch print and not see any noise.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's fantastic. And that's the D90, which is, you know, about $1,600-$1,700 for the body. So it's an expensive little camera, but, you know, nonetheless, what a great piece of gear.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a little bit of an interesting playoff at the moment. It will be interesting to see where it all goes. I hope, for Canon and Sony users' sake, that the noise range in this thing, in these two new cameras, will compare very well with, you know,
the
700 and the D3. When Nikon bring out their you know, new flagship, which they will have to, I'd say, yeah, it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
Yeah.
Mm. But so far, look, I'm really looking forward to getting my D700 and shooting with it. I really, really am. So come on, Nikon Australia, give me my camera.
You'll have to get in Craig's ear and make sure he gets it to you before you go to Patagonia.
Yeah, he said, look, if I can't, mate, I will give you a D3 to take with you. So I'll have something. Yeah, have something.
Awesome.
It'll be nice. I'm looking forward to that. So it'll be interesting, but I'd like to have my own baby by then, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But there'll be some great pictures come out of that tour, and of course, you know, we'll all get to see them. So I'm looking forward to that very, very much.
And you're off to the land of the long white cloud.
I am, yeah. I'm off to Aotearoa in October for the North New Zealand Photographic Society Convention. I've been asked to speak there over a couple of days and then run a couple of workshops. So if you live in New Zealand, I'll be in Auckland in mid-October for that convention. And I'll be speaking on the Saturday and speaking on the Sunday and then running a workshop on the Monday and the Tuesday and then flying home.
Wow.
So love to catch up with you. If you're a podcast listener and you're in the land of the long white cloud, come up to Auckland and say good day, because it'd be lovely to meet with you. And that's where I'll be. Looking forward to that very much. So that's October, then November, Patagonia. And then hopefully sometime around, you know, the end of December, I'll be able to sort of put my feet up for a couple of days. It's been crazy. Absolutely nuts.
Yeah, I feel the same way. This year, it just seems like, you know, like as well as working the 5 days a week, which has been a rude shock, there's also just been so much other stuff going on. I don't know if you're alone in that.
Oh, good. I'm glad. But I'm looking forward to some time off, you know. So from our podcast listeners, those who still love us, of course, those that remain, have we had any interesting emails? I haven't had anything coming from our listeners for weeks. Maybe they think we're dead.
I keep getting emails and Facebook messages from people going, when is Shutters Inc. coming back? Which is
great. We are going to do what we can to keep it regular, folks. We're going to eat our bran and keep it as regular as possible. But it's just a matter of, you know, Bruce has got a family to feed and so have I. And it just takes time to, you know, to coordinate his schedule and mine. It's not that easy.
That's it.
I said, Bruce was down here for 4 days and I didn't get a minute to see him. So factor that into your understanding that we love doing this thing, folks, but sometimes we just can't. But I know that when we left our last podcast off, we were still talking about off-camera flash, and we had a few questions about how to work it exposure-wise and that kind of thing. It seemed that, you know, this is a little bit of an issue. Am I right in my memory, Bruce?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. The issue with off-camera flash is basically the mantra at Shutters Inc. has been, and it's become a popular mantra. I'm seeing it all over the internet now, from listeners' blogs and that kind of thing. You find a light and put them in it.
If only you put a trademark on that.
Yeah, I should have registered it. You know, still might find a light and put them in it. And that's been our you know mantra here, and it's worked very well for people. I know when I run. My photography workshops here in Melbourne and podcast listeners come, you know, they use that very mantra in you know, organizing the shots for the afternoon. And it's great to see. Off-camera flash is exactly the same thing, except that it's make the light and put them in it.
Yeah.
And therein, if you just remember that as your off-camera flash mantra, you have all the principles sorted out, essentially. The decision that you have to make when you take your flash off the camera is, am I going to make this a supplementary or primary light source? In other words, am I going to use the available light and just add a touch of flash to fill something in, to add a hair light, whatever? Or am I going to make this the primary light source? Is this now going to become my new sunlight or my new window light or whatever? And once you've made that decision, then you basically have to go into the technical mode. Okay, how am I going to achieve this? And this is where a lot of photographers don't understand the interplay between ambient light exposure and flash exposure. And this is simply because we're so used to TTL flash now that we don't understand the mathematics of flash and how it affects our settings, our camera settings, in terms of shutter speed and aperture. Essentially, what I do, and I, because I'm so used to working with my cameras in this mode, I can do it fairly, you know, easily, second nature, really. But I would suggest that we all get used to doing this. If the decision is supplementary, in other words, I'm just going to add a little bit of flash, you probably, if you have a wireless system like the Nikon CLS system or the Canon with the STE2 transmitter, or any of the wireless systems that are around that are TTL, let the camera decide. Often, it's going to do a good job for you. However, if you've decided to make the flash the primary light source, you're going to have to do some tweaking because the camera can't read your mind, and you're going to have to make the camera and the flash work to your advantage. Now, if that's the decision, your flash will be your primary light source. The first decision is, where am I going to put it, and how do I want it to affect my subject? The subject, let's say, is a human being, a bride, a model, a portrait. You're photographing a person, let's say.
Can I just jump in and ask you a question here?
Certainly, yeah.
And now, I'll preface this by saying I still don't have a generic flash, so I haven't had much chance to use my off-camera flash transmitter thingy yet.
Yep. But, your little Chinese one?
Yeah, that's the one. But but the one thing that's been running through my mind in sort of in preparation for when I do get myself a generic flash is, you know, with the aforementioned subject of, you know, trying to shoot a portrait of a person using off-camera flash, how do you, Shelton Muller, professional photographer who does this for a living, when you decide to use off-camera flash, how do you work out what angle to have the flash at so that you don't get shadows from hair across eyes and things like that? Because that's the, you know, I was thinking about this, thinking, you know, so often, you know, you take a shot with flash that is off camera, or if you, you know, because I've done a lot of bounce stuff, you know, sometimes it all looks great when you look through the lens, but then later on you get to look at the image and the flash has contributed to the lighting of the shot, and it has cast a shadow from, you know, say, you know, a female with long hair, and it might, the hair may have cast a shadow over a face, but you can't tell that until the flash goes off. So how do you compensate for that, or, you know, how
good
do you
point.
Work it out?
Yeah, look, if you're dealing with models, you know, and very rarely do we get the chance to work with top models because we just can't afford $10,000 today. But any good model knows, and I hate to admit this, but I have been a watcher of America's Next Top Model for quite a few seasons now.
Oh, okay.
And I don't watch it for the catfights, I watch it for the shoots, and I watch it for what the photographers are doing. And every time the photographers basically, you talk to the models, and, you know, the compares of the show talk to the models, excuse me, they say to them, look, understand where the light is coming from. And models need to understand, and good models are trained, and often good models become good photographers because they actually get an understanding of where the photographer has put his key light, where he's put his fill light, and then they respond to that.
Right.
And you'll see the models actually looking where the light is and turning their faces in that direction, turning their bodies against it, and turning their faces around to it, et cetera, et cetera. And they know that they look in that direction. Now, if a model has to know that, then surely the photographer, you know,
should also know it.
He's a, And some of them make, you know, terrible mistakes. But if you're going to, you know, and they're professionals, but, you know, often I think it's because they fail to direct the models who don't know to turn into the light.
Right.
And that's what I've been teaching at my flash workshops and also just directing models to do. Is look, I've set the flash up here. I want, you know, it's off to me, it's off to my left. What I want you to do is turn away from me, but turn your face round so that your face will be into the flash. If I'm photographing a wedding, I just say to the couple, look at the guy holding the flash. And so they look at him and bang. So you're actually, and then of course, if there is hair in front of the face, you just get it off the face. You have to basically predict what the light is going to do. But a good model will know to turn into the light. If the model knows that, the photographer should know that.
Yeah.
They're, you know, and that's all part of your decision. So, yes, you sort it out, your camera's on a tripod or wherever you put it down where you're going to stand. You set your flash up, your carbon-based voice-activated light stand or your real light stand over here. And you set your model up in front of you, in front of the situation, scene, context that she's going to be standing in front of, the bride, the groom, whatever. Pose them, but you make sure that if your flash is now the primary light source, that you get them to turn into it. This is what I do all the time. And if you look at my off-camera flash portraits, I have this formula, ritual, where I just get them to turn into the direction of the flash, and it will fall beautifully across their face. So that's all part of your decision as to whether the flash is going to be supplementary or primary. Naturally, if it's primary, basically, that's the way you've got to do it, and otherwise, what's the point of it? The next part of that situation, the scene, the photograph that you have to manage is exposure, and this is where it's a good idea to shoot manually, even if you've got a wireless flash system. But it's a good idea either way to shoot manually. Hmm. What I do is I will take an ambient exposure reading, and let's say, for instance, it's F8 at 125th, or I just pull out the old classic. F8 at 125th. Now, if I've got a TTL flash system, or not, you know, even if it's not a TTL flash system, set the camera up manually, manual exposure, and take an ambient exposure reading. But you want the flash to become a primary light source. Now, if it's a TTL system like the Nikon or the Canon, and you just take the shot at the ambient light reading, what's basically going to happen is the flash says, or the camera says to the flash, well, I've got this covered. I really don't need you to work that hard. And the flash says, okay, fair enough. And it just adds a little twinkle of light, and there's not much effect. You're set manually at one or two stops under that. So so let's say you've gone to 250th of a second at F8. Well, now you're underexposing a stop. Your camera then, if it's working with wireless TTL, is saying to the flash, hang on, this guy's an idiot, because he's underexposing a little bit here. You've got to work harder. But that's the whole idea. You're actually telling your camera to tell your flash to do the very thing that it has to make up for, the fact that you're underexposing a stop. So the flash now fills in where you leave off and becomes a more primary light source. Now, let's say you want it even to have greater effect. Well, then you'd set your aperture at f11. You wouldn't want to go higher than a 250th of a second because it probably wouldn't synchronize. But you can take your aperture and you can set that at f11. Now you're f11 at 250th of a second, whereas your ambient reading is f8 at 125th. So you set your camera manually two stops the ambient reading is. Your camera will now tell your flash, this guy's a complete idiot. Sorry, but you're going to have to fill harder, and it really becomes a serious primary light source. So your model will find herself standing in an underexposed context while your flash works to fill in and become the primary light. You can use the sun as a hair light or whatever if you want to. And that I've often done, use the sun as a hair light and the flash as a primary light. It looks pretty cool, really.
Yeah.
And so that's the way of it behind, and that's how you decide. That's basically how you make the decision as to whether your flash is going to be supplementary or primary, by underexposing the ambient and getting the flash to work harder. In principle, It's exactly the same with a non-TTL-controlled wireless system, such as the Chinese triggers that you've got.
Yep.
You have to do exactly the same thing, but you have to do the math with the flash and the guide number. And therein is your guide number divided by distance equals f-stop.
Yep.
So you really can't change your f-stop all that much, unless, of course, you've got variable manual power control on your flash.
The reverse of that is that guide over f-stop will give you distance.
Guide number over distance equals f-stop.
Yeah, so but I'm saying you could reverse that as well, couldn't you? Guide over f-stop would then give you distance.
Yes.
So if you wanted to shoot at a specific aperture, you would then be able to calculate what distance you would need your flash from your subject.
Absolutely.
Cool.
Absolutely. And so let's say you want to set it at F11 at 250th, because that's two stops under the ambient exposure. Yeah, you then just pace it out.
I'm sort of thinking more the other way. Like, you know, I'm doing a portrait, therefore I want a really wide open aperture. I want to shoot it at F2.8 because I want narrow depth of field. So, you know, I could then do the maths and go, well, based on the guide number of my flash and the fact that I want to shoot at F2.8, it means I need my wireless flash to be 15 meters away from the subject.
Yes. That's exactly how you do it.
Cool.
That's exactly how you do it. You work out the guide number of your flash at whatever power setting you've got.
Yeah.
Full pelt or half or eighth or 16th power or whatever your flash does. And then you just simply pace it out. 1 meter, 2 meter, 3 meter, 4 meter. Put it on a stand or a tripod or a carbon-based voice-activated light stand, and you know, like Max or Kathy, right?
Yep.
you're on hand family assistance, and that's how you do it. That's exactly how you do it.
Cool.
And in that way, you're controlling how much effect your flash has on your subject, and therein is the secret behind off-camera flash in terms of primary versus supplementary, and the power of that. Is the ability to say, well, this is either going to be supplementary or primary.
Right.
And it's all a matter of aperture and shutter speed, ambient exposure versus flash exposure. And once we understand the simple math of that, and that's really all it is, like you say, the reverse of it. You worked it out in your head there and then, and you're not a very smart bloke. You can do it.
Thanks, mate.
you can do it. Anybody can, right? It really is that simple. And that's why anybody can get these $40 Chinese trigger thingies, a $20 flash from a secondhand store, and do off-camera flash, with any camera. You could get an old, you can get an old Leica, you could get an old Pentax Spotmatic, for Pete's sake, and you could do off-camera flash based on that simple calculation. They have been doing it for decades.
It's actually one of the things that I like about that, you know, this little cheap Chinese off, you know, camera trigger thingy that I've bought is that you do have to, you know, shoot manually and think and, you know, and do some maths, because I think it's better for us to keep those skills alive than to rely on, you know, these systems which will do it all for you.
Yes, absolutely. I love the convenience of technology.
Yep.
But one thing that constantly astounds me when I run photography workshops is what people do not know.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that in an insulting fashion. I really don't.
Yeah.
But, you know, in my day, way back in my day, we had to learn these things. I took up photography in the late 70s when I was about 15. And I soon learned about shutter speeds and apertures and depth of field and all those things, because I could only afford a camera, a mechanical manual camera.
Yeah.
It was a 1, and apart from having a built-in meter, that's it. That's you had to do everything manually and mechanically, and so I learned, and it was a serious advantage to me, because now people come and they turn up and they've got D300s and 5Ds and these awesome technological bits of gear, but they don't understand the principles of how these things work.
No.
And when their photos don't turn out the way they envisage them, they don't know what to do. They don't know why it hasn't turned out properly. They don't know why it hasn't turned out the way that they had envisaged it. And they don't understand that it's simply a matter of changing this setting and changing this setting, and off you go.
And then they think that if they only had some more megapixels, that it'd all be right.
Exactly. You know, or if my camera had this piece of technology, I could... But to be honest with you, buy the simplest, cheapest piece of rubbish, and you know, and you can take awesome pictures with it.
Yeah.
If you know the principles. But I'm constantly astounded that by what people do not know. You know, yeah. basic understandings of shutter speeds and apertures, the math and the yin and yang between them, they don't get it. And then if you do a flash workshop and you have to go through guide number divided by, you know, distance equals f-stop, or, you know, okay, and it's like an epiphany. Once yeah. they understand it, a whole new world of photography potential and possibility opens up, and it's just fantastic. I love seeing the little lights come on. That's the reward for me for running workshops. I love seeing those lights come on.
I would urge every Shutters Inc. listener to get, you know, an old business card that you are about to throw in the bin that's only printed on one side, turn it over, and on the back of it write, guide number over f-stop equals distance, and guide number over distance equals f-stop. And yeah. leave that in your camera bag until you are so sick of looking at that card that it's burned into your memory cells forever.
Yes.
I just think, you know, that of everything you've spoken about, yeah, certainly in the last half dozen episodes, that has really just changed my perception of flash 1,000%.
I'm glad. Mm. I can see Bruce Williams will be out this weekend now with his trigger and his $20 flash, and off you go. And you know what? That's all you need.
Yeah.
If you go to the Strobist website there, they suggest that you buy a Vivitar 285, which is a great flash.
I haven't been able to find a secondhand flash as cheap as you seem to think they're around.
Oh, mate, just head on down to pawn shops and cash converters, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, I've seen them for $15, $20,
okay.
you know. Yeah, because they're old rubbish. Basically, they're considered old rubbish.
Yeah.
If it's not an SB900 or a 580EX or something like that,
yeah.
it's old rubbish. But you know what? It's not old rubbish.
Yeah.
You can, you know, if you can get a Metz 45 CT1, you can pick them up for $100-$150. They are an awesome piece of gear.
Yeah. Well, geez, a lot of pro photographers still use them.
Yes, they do. And so you don't need... I mean, I love the Nikon CLS system, and I use it all the time. But the thing is, I understand how it works in principle, and I can override it by setting my camera manually and saying, okay, flash, you do your thing. But and that's the way that, as I described in today's podcast, that I work my off-camera flash, and I'm going to be learning to do some, you know, more stuff. I'll be learning as I go as well.
Yep.
But that's how I control its output.
Yeah.
But exactly the same principle could apply with a $20 flash gun and a Chinese trigger,
mm-hmm.
you know, or you know, you really want to go back, a long cord,
exactly.
you know, plugged into your flash and your camera. The same principles have always applied. Once you understand them, the whole world opens up to you and off you go. And look, so buy a Vivitar 285 or buy, you know, a Metz 45 or head down your local pawn shop and say, mate, you got any old flashes sitting here?
Yeah.
Buy it, put some batteries in it, get a Chinese trigger off the internet, and away you go. It's that simple. Just do the simple math. It really is very simple math. It's 40 divided by 10 equals 4. Okay, well, yeah. you know, it's yeah. easy.
Yeah.
You know, it's not a difficult thing to do at all. And I reckon we're going to be seeing some photos by Bruce Williams very soon with his off-camera flash.
Yeah, and if you're looking for a flash that you can do off-camera flash, try and find one with a guide number of 10, 20, 30, or 40, because it'll make the maths easier.
Yes, that's true. And remember, of course, that the guide number is usually in meters.
It's funny that you should mention that, because I've noticed on eBay that in America, they quite often quote the guide number as feet. Which
yes.
is rather confusing. So you need to be aware of that, mainly for our international listeners, that if you are going to buy something off eBay and it's coming from America, just make sure that you are aware that the guide number may be quoted in feet, not meters.
Yes, and often that's done to make the flash appear more powerful.
Yeah.
You know, guide number of 100 in feet, which is like 30 meters.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So, you know, be very careful. Whatever it is, as long as you understand that that's the distance measurement that they're using,
yeah.
well, then you just walk 100 feet, you know,
yeah.
instead of 30 meters. That's all that, you know, you really have to do. So, you know, naturally, if you're using 200 or 400 or 800, you're going to have to do your math. But you know, that's where it comes down to understanding the principles, and that's where old timers like me have all the advantages to you know, those who have, and I feel sorry for people who've come on line recently into photography, bought their DSLR, and you know, hoped for the best. There's an element of almost inspired, forgive my frankness, inspired laziness that comes with these cameras.
Yeah.
That, you know, point it, shoot it, and it'll do it all for you. It actually doesn't.
No.
It really, and it never, ever will. Learn these principles and tell your camera what to do. Don't let it tell you, because your pictures are never going to turn out the way you want them.
No.
To the way you pre-visualize them, if you let the camera make the decisions.
I think this is just a reflection of our age, matey, is that when you've been in a game long enough, you've learned so much of the background theory that you get to a point where you see these young whippersnappers coming into the industry and they don't know squat.
That's right.
Because I find it exactly the same in audio. You know, I have, you know... Yeah, kids that come into radio studios and are amazed at what I know, you know, from the audio courses being run in Sydney, and likewise with my podcast listeners who, you know, constantly go, oh, wow, it's amazing how much you know and understand this stuff, and I just don't get it. And I think, well, you know, if you devote 20 years of your life to it like I have, you'll probably end up like I am now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
The photographies are no different.
Yeah, and you keep learning, but you know,
yeah, exactly.
You have a foundation, an established solid foundation upon which to learn. If you've started in building the walls of your house and the roof of your house before you've got the foundation down, it's all just going to fall in on you eventually.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what it is with photography. Don't just rush headlong into the digital technology of things and the pixels and the whatnot of it all without understanding what shutter speeds, apertures, guide number, depth of field, all those basic principles do. Get down and dirty in there. And no matter what camera you're using, you'll be able to pick up a 100-year-old Leica, and you'll be able to take pictures with it.
Yeah.
You know, you'll be able to pick up the latest, you know, Sony A900 and take pictures with it, because you should be able to pick that camera up, put it on M, and just go and just take pictures.
Yeah.
Set your own shutter speeds and apertures. There was a lady recently who was at my, she's come to now four of my workshops, three workshops and a shoot, and get the camera on manual and set the camera manually. It was a major feat. But I told her she had to do it because the scene she was photographing, the camera did not meter and produce the image. The camera did not meter and produce the image as I was teaching it to be produced.
Right.
We'd set up a model profile in window light, and I said meter for the highlights to get the effect of this shot. She did not know that if you leave the camera on auto, it's going to meter for everything and give you your best go.
Mm.
She had to put the camera on manual and literally underexpose a stop or two just to expose for the highlights. And that was a major, major feat to get her to do that, because she was so used to pointing and shooting and just hoping for the best.
Yeah.
It doesn't work. It just doesn't work. That's why this podcast, I've always tried to, you know, talk about these principles on this podcast. Learn them, and you know what? The advantage is not only great images, but more enjoyment from your photography.
One of the things that I've been, you know, forcing myself to do over the last probably 12 months or so is looking at a scene, and before I lift the camera to my eye, is trying to calculate for myself what aperture, what shutter speed, and what ISO would give an accurate reading of the scene. And I've found that with practice, I've become very, I won't say I'm, you know, 100% accurate, but I'm pretty close in the ballpark every time. Where I think to myself, okay, I'm shooting at 200 ISO or I'm shooting at 400 ISO, and given the light, I reckon I'm probably going to be looking at about a 60th at f5.6 or whatever.
Yep.
And then I bring the camera up to my eye, and I've got it at that ISO, and I'm shooting in aperture priority more often than not, and I'm usually, you know, within a half a stop or, you know, one stop.
Well done.
Which I just think, you know, is good practice.
It is very good practice. gut metering. Gut metering. I learned to do that again when I in Vietnam a few years ago, and I might have told you the story. I bought this seriously old rangefinder camera with no meter in it, and
right.
You know, and it's a bunch of springs and cogs with a lens, basically.
Yeah.
And I walked the streets of Vietnam with some black and white film, and I just gut metered the whole thing. I got some right, I got some wrong,
yep.
But it was such a great return to the fundamentals. It was, you know, a really great thing. And I do the same thing now.
I
look at something, and yep, I do that. And it's a great suggestion you make, Bruce. Just like you said, I would suggest all our podcast listeners go through, and if they've got the camera in their hand, look at it. This is a 15th at f4, you know, or
yeah.
this is f11 at a 250th, and just say that to themselves, then pick up the camera and see whether they were right. Now, the thing is, they may have been right, and the camera may be wrong.
Yeah.
That's the other thing.
Of course, yes.
The camera may take a picture, and it may not turn out the way you envisaged it, in which case, you were right. Take a picture at the exposure you thought it would be, and see whether you were right and the camera was wrong, because often it is.
Yeah,
the camera
right.
is influenced by all sorts of light sources and scenes. You may have been right, and it may have been wrong. Give that a try. You know, you're a smart human being. Let you know, don't discount
your own abilities.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, exactly. And I see that also happening so much, where photographers lack the confidence of their own, you know, of their own decisions and their own intelligence. You know, I'll say to people, shoot, you know, put it on manual. Now, what's your camera saying? Oh, it's saying f8 at 125th. Okay, but that's going to be wrong. Set it at f11 at 250th. Oh, but hang on, it's going, the little arrow is going, the little notches are going down. You know, yeah, exactly, because your camera's wrong. What? My camera's wrong? Yes, your camera's wrong. And to get
but I
them
just
to,
paid $1,500 for this camera.
Exactly. It's wrong. You know, it's a great piece of gear, but it's no match for your eye and it's no match for your mind.
Yeah.
And getting that little lesson through is a major thing. But once it's through, you know, once people leave my workshops, if they've been working on manual all day or for a part of the day, they really do appreciate the value of knowing and understanding those principles in the camera. So, you know, everybody at Shutters Inc., give that a try. Get somebody and a landscape, a portrait, whatever, shoot manually. Get an old flash, get a Chinese eBay trigger and do your math, your guide number divided by distance equals f-stop or the reverse of that, and do it. And once you understand it, once you've got it, you just jump up and down and you say, yes, Eureka, I have found it. And you know exactly what to do from then on in. It is a lesson you'll never forget.
Excellent. All right, mate. Well, thank you for all of that.
My pleasure.
Good to catch up again.
It's nice to be back. Really is.
I just wish we could nail down a time of the week where it worked for us. But anyway.
Yeah. We'll have to keep playing it by ear. Bear with us, Shutters Inc. listeners, because we do love doing this.
Yep.
And we do love you. But just life changes, okay? So bear with us. We're still here.
Excellent. All right, mate. Well, you take care, and we'll hopefully catch up sometime soon.
I hope so too, mate. I really do. And we'll work to that end for our sake, but more importantly, for the sake of our loyal listeners.
Absolutely. All right, mate. Catch you later.
Good on you, mate. See you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
This has been another AudioToYou.com podcast. For previous episodes, check out
ShuttersIncPodcast.com.
Please send questions, comments, or feedback to studio@audiotou.com.